Detected containment. I haven't even been to the sure now. No, I have to go to the center. Here's some sphere. Nobody here ever goes home. No, not the only one. Call me. I called him. He didn't even call me.
Yeah.
Doing well. So I want to talk a little bit about the mitzvah of the four cups of wine. Then we'll throw it open to some questions and answers people might have. We know that that the Chachamim were mesakein to augment the Seder, which is the mitzvah the Araisa of Sipra Yitzias Mitzrayim and Achilas Matzah, but the Rabbanan added an extra mitzvah of drinking four cups of wine, or a grape juice, or whatever it would be, because this is considered to be an expression of celebration, an expression of cheiris, of freedom. And there are a number of reasons why we have the four cups of wine, but the most commonly given reason is that the Chachamim looked at the four Lashonos of redemption. That when Hashem told Moshe to go to Paro and get the freedom of the Jewish people, there were four Lashonos of redemption in Parshas Vayera, Vodseisi, I will take them out, Vitzalti, I will save them, Vegalti, I will redeem them, Vilakachti Eschem Liliam, I will take them unto me as a people, and Keneged, the four Lashonos of Geula, Chazal were Misakein, four cups of wine. There is, of course, a fifth Lashon of Geula, Behevesi Eschem El Oretz, I will bring them to Eretz Yisrael. And that is why there is actually one opinion in the Gemara, Rabbi Tarfon's opinion, that you have to drink five cups of wine, a Kais Chamishi. We do not paskin like Rabbi Tarfon, although some Hasidim have such a minhag. And indeed, the Maral of Prague, based on other Gainim, earlier Gainim, says the Chatchila, one should drink a Kais Chamishi. Our minhag is not to do it. However, and the reason is because Vehevesi Eschem El Haaretz is really referring to the Messianic Kibbutz Golius, which hasn't happened yet, and that is the Ashkenazic Makor for what we call the Kos of Eliyahu, which is a fifth cup that is poured, but it's not drunk, at least among Ashkenazim. Sephardim actually don't have that custom unless they borrowed it from Ashkenazim, which sometimes happens in both directions. But Ashkenazim have the minhag of Koshel Eliyahu. And what is the purpose of Koshel Eliyahu? Because when Mashiach comes, who will be announced by Eliyahu HaNavi, we will drink that fifth cup. Right now, it's on the table. We don't drink it, but it is a simon for Mashiach, who will be announced by Eliyahu HaNavi. Now, the question that one might ask is this. So Chazal were Mesaken, four cups of wine. So first of all, you have to understand, the Briskerov would explain that there are two different dinim, two different aspects in the four cups of wine. One is there's a mitzvah to drink four cups of wine. Right? You have to drink four cups of wine. But there's a second mitzvah, which is equally important, and that is that the recitation of every part of the Haggadah has to be on a cup. Meaning it is part of how you fulfill your Amira. So Kiddush must be said on wine. The Magid must be said on wine. Now this is important. This is why you have to follow instructions when you fill up the cup. You'll notice in the Haggadah that we fill up the cup before the Manishtana. Now you might say, why is that important? I'll fill up the cup before I drink it. It'll be an hour and a half or more till I'm going to drink it. No, that's not good enough. Because you're mechuyev to recite, just like you're mechuyev to recite Kiddush on wine, you are mechuyev to recite Haggadah on wine, you are mechuyev to recite Birkas HaMazon on wine, and you are mechuyev to recite Hallel on wine. Ad kidei kach, that briskers have the minhag, that they actually hold the cup of wine for all of these things. Just like we hold the cup of wine when we say Kiddush, they hold the cup of wine throughout the Haggadah, as opposed to our standard instruction that only says you pick up the cup of wine at certain points.
And Ad Kidei Kach, the Briska Rav used to say that you're only Makayim the mitzvah of drinking on the cup in which you were Makayim the mitzvah of Amira. What that would mean is that if I recited the Haggadah over a cup of wine, and that cup of wine spills before I drank the second cup, I can't just fill the second cup and make Brei Pri Hagaven. I have to recite the whole Haggadah again in order that it should be a Kais Shel Bracha, so to speak. And by the way, it's not just the Haggadah, but each one has a Bracha on it, right? On the first cup, we have Mekadesh Yisrael Vazmanim. On the second cup, we also have a Bracha. At the end of the Maggid is Bracha to Hashem Go'al Yisrael. On the third cup, we have all of the blessings of Birkas HaMazon before we drink the third cup. And on the fourth cup, we have the bracha at the end of Hallel. And again, that itself was a big, big machlokas. So if your family are using different Haggadahs, you may want to coordinate. So machlokas is really in the Gemara, ultimately. But is the chasima of Hallel Melech Muhulal Batishbachos, which is the normal chasima of Hallel, or is it the chasima of Yishtabach, HaBocher B'Shirei Zimra, Melech Keil Chei HaOlamim? Different Haggadahs are different because they're machlokes in the Gemara, and the different Rishayim pask in different ways, but each host has a special bracha, not just Brei Pri Hagaven, a special bracha that is recited on that host before you make the Brei Pri Hagaven and drink the host.
How much of the cup do you have to spill to be liable to do the Hagadah again?
Oh, how much of the host? Well, basically, as long as there are 4 ounces left in the host, you're okay. Yeah. By the way, a little minog, you know, we know that in the course of the Seder, we spill out a total of 16 drops of wine when we talk about the 10 plagues. The way it works is when we have the phrase, Dam v'yesh v'simros ashan, blood and fire and pillars of smoke, that's 3. Then we have the 10 makos, Dam v'yesh, which is 10. And then we have the Makos in abbreviation, Datsach, Adash, Ba'achav, another 3. So it's a total of 16 drops that are poured from the cup, and there are 2 minhagim of doing it. Some take the drop with the finger, and some pour it out that way. It is wrong. You do not pour out that wine back into the cup. That you don't do. But it is proper to fill up the cup, meaning if the cup was diminished, you fill up the cup with new wine. Now, if you ask people, why do we... This is a very, very interesting historical observation. What is the reason why we pour out the wine? So the reason that everybody in the world knows, even the non-religious Jews know this, everybody knows this reason, is that since this is the part of the Haggadah that talks about the 10 plagues, and the 10 plagues involved the infliction of suffering on the Egyptians, so our joy is not complete when other people suffer. So as a result, just as when the angels wanted to praise Hashem for the splitting of the Red Sea, so Hashem said to the angels, my creatures are drowning in the ocean, in the sea, do not say Shira, so our joy is diminished by pouring out the wine. Right? Everyone knows, I'm sure everyone knows this. This is the official reason that is given. Now, what is very, very interesting is that this is actually not the reason that the Rishonim give. The minhag of pouring out the wine is not in the Gemara, but the first source that indicates the minhag of pouring out the wine is the Maharil. Maharil is an extremely, Rav Yaakov Molin. The Maharil is extremely, extremely important. He lived in Germany in the 1300s, and he is kemat the official source for all the minhagim of Ashkenazim, Maharil. The Ramah brings Maharil many, 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 many times. So Maharil is the person who records all of these minhagim. And the reason the Maharil gives is the other way around, that since the makos are called the finger of Hashem, so we kind of take out the wine with the finger, and red wine is midas adin and punishment, etc. We also remove the wine from the cup as if to say the makos shouldn't affect us, it should only go on them. It's kind of the opposite. It's not commiseration for the Egyptians. Now, if you look in the Art Scroll, or any Haggadah that gives you a Makor for this, they will say that the idea of commiseration for the Egyptians emanates from the Abarbanel. Right? The Abarbanel wrote a huge, huge commentary on the Haggadah, and the Abarbanel gives this reason. Okay, now I have to admit, although the Abarbanel is a wonderful parish, and I've used the Abarbanel a lot, I never read it page by page, so I figured, all right, it's in there, it must be in there, I just didn't see it. But somebody who actually did read the Abarbanel page by page told me it's not in the Abarbanel. All right, so some other Haggadahs credit it to the Avudraham, who is another great sefer. Avudraham is much less on the Haggadah, so I looked at the Avudraham, it's not in the Avudraham. In point of fact, somebody did a real, real big research on this. And they say this thought was never expressed anywhere until the middle of the 1800s in the drushas of a German rabbi, an Orthodox rabbi, who came up with a chiddush that this is commiseration for Maisa Yadai Tovu B'Yam. See, guys, what he's connecting is, he's connecting the Chazal by Kriyas Yamsuf, and he's applying it to the Ten Makos. And in a way, this is not such a good comparison, because Kriyas Yamsuf, on the seventh day of Pesach, we only say a half Hallel because of the suffering. All right, so we are commiserating. On the first night of Pesach, we say a whole Hallel. Right, so to say that we're commiserating with the Egyptians on the night that we say the whole Hallel is kind of a contradiction. So be it as it may, maybe because this explanation is a beautiful explanation, maybe because it expresses compassion, which is of course a Jewish value, maybe because it's politically correct, this reason has crowded out every other reason. And now the question is, why does the Abarbanel, why does the Art Scroll say Abarbanel, Avudraham? All of that is not true. How did that happen? Well, the way it happened was this. This vort appears in a book of drushos by Rav Yirmiyahu Levi, and his grandson was Binyamin Levi, and his grandson printed the Svarim, and at the end of the Sefer he adds some extra things he heard from his grandfather, and this is a vort he heard from his grandfather about why you pour out the wine, and he says it as a chiddush of his grandfather. And whenever Rav Binyamin added something, he would preface it with Aleph Beis. Aleph Beis just means Omar Binyamin, Dover Zesh Shamati Me'er Zekeni. So, some later anthologist sees Aleph Beis and sees this word. Now, Aleph Beis is often an abbreviation for either Abarbanel or Avudraham. So, some anthologist said that the vort is in the name of Abarbanel and Avudraham. Now, the way anthologies work is, and this is a real big problem, people will often just use secondary sources. So if some Haggadah says, this is from the Abarbanel, and I'm doing my own Haggadah, I'll just put it the Abarbanel, without going back to the Abarbanel. And therefore, it becomes like a plague. It just spreads. All of the Haggadahs are English, Hebrew, all connected to the Abarbanel or the Avudraham, when in fact it has nothing to do with the Abarbanel or the Avudraham, because once one person made the mistake, people were copying from that, and that spread. So that's an interesting bibliographical shot. But be it as it may, the question becomes, what is the significance of the four cups of wine? Because of four l'shaynus of Geula. When Yetzias Mitzrayim was a single redemption, why do we talk about four l'shonos of Geula? So the Meshech Chachma of Meir Simcha says that when a person is a slave, when a nation is enslaved, there are four different dangers that they face. And because there are four different dangers that they face, they need to be redeemed in four Geulos, because there are four Sakanos. Sakana number one is danger to your very life. When a person is enslaved, they could be murdered, they could be killed, their children could be taken from them. So the first and very basic danger that a slave faces is physical annihilation. That is danger number one. Danger number two is spiritual assimilation. This, of course, happened to the Jewish people. 4/5 of the Jewish people died in the plague of darkness, because they had basically left Hashem totally. But of the 1/5 that remained, they were not righteous in an ultimate sense. Most of them, except for the tribe of Levi, were Ovdei Avodah Zarah. Most of them, except for the tribe of Levi, did not practice circumcision. But they still had some sechus, but they were on the 49th level of impurity. And had they stayed even another minute, that's why we didn't have time to let our dough rise to bake it as chametz, they would have hit level number 50. And in ways we don't understand, how do you become level number 50 in 1 second? But it would have happened. We would have been irredeemable. So the 210 years in Mitzrayim was an awful, awful, awful cost of our spiritual identity, of our value system, of the legacy of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And therefore that is danger number two. Is danger number one is danger to your physical life. Danger number two is danger to your values and to your spiritual life. Now there is a third sakana that one faces, and it's connected. And this is psychological. When a person is a slave, they often become disconnected from their past. You know, and again, this is a phenomenon that's even independent of religion, but it obviously religion will feed into it. And that is, when a person is a slave, there is no sense they come from anything. There is no sense they have a history. There is no sense that they have a family to what they're connected to. You know, families were ripped apart, children were sold here, parents were sold here. Even the American slavery was exactly that way. In the 1970s, before you guys were born, but there was a big, big phenomenon in America. A black man, Alex Haley, had written about his family history, Roots. It was a story, not a novel really, but a kind of a fictionalized autobiography. And then it was a mini-series, all sorts of things, about the history of slavery in the United States, that these were people who had come from yichus on some level. They had come from good families and powerful families with wealth and creativity and talents. But the message they got as a slave over and over again is, you're a nobody, you're a nothing. You come from nothing. And we know, as the saying goes, if one does not know where they come from, one does not know what direction they're supposed to go. So the psychological devastation of being enslaved for decades, for hundreds of years, is that a person has no shaychus to their past. They feel they don't come from anything. And then the last sakana that a slave faces, which might be the worst of all, is a lack of hope in the future that things can ever be different. A person's born a slave, they die a slave, their father was a slave, their grandfather was a slave. At some point you just give up. At some point you feel the future can never be any better than this. This is what my life is. This is what our destiny is. Now, giving up hope is a very, very significant event. Even in the medical situation, when a person convinces themselves that they're going to die of their illness, even if the illness could be healed, the body begins to shut down in a way that is often irrevocable, irreversible. People who believe in voodoo, which is ridiculous, right? Voodoo is that belief that if I stick a pen in some type of effigy, you'll drop dead. Well, people who believe in voodoo, if they see somebody stick a pen into their image, they do drop dead. Not because voodoo means anything, but because if you believe you're going to die, you die. That's mind over matter. You could call it reverse placebo, right? We know with placebos, if a person believes something will make him better, there's a certain hashpa of the mind over the body. Well, this is a reverse placebo. If you believe something's going to kill you, if you think you took poison and there's no refuah, one might drop dead even if it's only water. So this is the notion of hope. Hope is what keeps a person alive. It's what gives the person the ability to transition into a new state. So the Meshech Chachma says, I added a few things to it, obviously, but the Meshech Chachma says that Avdus has four sakanos that can destroy a person and can destroy a nation. Number one, there is the risk to their physical survival. Number two, their spiritual assimilation. Number three, their lack of connection to the past. And number four, their sense of hopelessness that there could ever be something that's different in the future. Four sakanos, four ka'ulos. He then goes on and says that in order for Klal Yisrael to be zoche to a ga'ula, there had to be some behavior on their part that addressed the problem. This is what Mikubalim used the Lashon, Isarusa Dilatata. Isarusa Dilatata means an awakening from below. One needs a little bit of awakening from below in order to bring the redemption from above, as small as it might be. So what were the behaviors of Klal Yisrael that made them be zoche to the four redemptions from the four sakanas? So Rav Meir Simcha uses a chazal which is in the Mechilta. This Mechilta is the halachic medrash on Shmos. And this is going to be a little different than the more common version that you hear from the Gemara in Saita. But he says, Chazal say in the Mechilta, there were four merits the Jewish people had which enabled them to be redeemed from Mitzrayim. Merit number one is they did not intermarry. There was only one case of a Jewish woman being with a non-Jewish man. That was the one that gave birth to the one who cursed, who blasphemed Hashem. But the Jewish people did not intermarry. They remained faithful. Jewish man, Jewish woman. That's zechus number one. Even though they were over the Avodah Zarah. Zechus number two. They did not speak Lashon Hara against each other. Zechus number three. They did not change their names. They kept the names that they had. They didn't take Egyptian names. And zechus number four, they continued to speak Lashon HaKodesh, the Hebrew language, again, not modern Hebrew, of course, you know, the Lashon HaKodesh. Now again, the Gemara in Saita adds, they didn't change their clothing, etc. But Rav Meir Simcha goes with these four merits. No intermarriage, no Lashon Hara, not changing their names, and keeping Lashon HaKodesh. Now remember, these were zechusim that helped a nation, one-fifth, even though they were idolaters who weren't doing bris milah. There was a certain malyusa, a certain spiritual benefit in speaking Hebrew, in keeping their Jewish names, in not intermarrying, and not speaking Lashon Hara. So here is what Rav Meir Simcha is going to say. Rav Meir Simcha is going to tell us that each of these merits, each of these behaviors, addresses one of the dangers that Avdus creates, and as a result it constitutes in Isarusa Dilatata an awakening from below that gives us the merit of the redemption from above. How is that so? So let's first take the sakana of physical survival. Right, a slave faces literally danger to their life. So here Rav Meir Simcha says the great thing that protects the Jewish people from physical danger is not speaking Lashon Hara. Now, why is that so? So here you have to understand. It's not, when we say they didn't speak Lashon Hara, it doesn't mean that they learned a halacha a day from Chafetz Chaim or Shmiras HaLashon. Their observance of Lashon Hara was not a matter of religiosity. It was not a matter of frumkeit. First of all, it was before Matan Torah. Rather, when it says they didn't speak Lashon Hara, it doesn't mean they didn't gossip between each other. But it means that no Jew informed on another Jew to the Egyptians to get whatever advantage they might want to get. Meaning, this was an expression of group loyalty, group togetherness. We are not going to compromise with the enemy for our own advantages at the expense of other people. Now you know, even during the Holocaust, superimposed on the great, great tragedy, the awesome tragedy of 6 million Jews dying, was the fact that there were sometimes Jews who actually did inform on other Jews. Now, again, we can't judge the pressure people were under. They thought that this is the only way they could get bread for their children. This is the only way they could keep their family alive, by becoming collaborators. Most of the time, by the way, it didn't work for them. The Nazis got whatever information they gave them and then killed them as well. But this is what didn't happen in Mitzrayim. In Mitzrayim, there was a hakara. We are in this together. There was achdus. There was avas Yisrael. There was never a sense of one person doing something for their benefit at the expense of the others. Even Dasan v'Aviram, who were hardly righteous people, they were the great troublemakers in the desert, but they were taskmasters over the slaves in Mitzrayim, and they got beaten again and again and again because they did not reveal which Jews didn't meet their quotas. Now I know you're probably going to ask, Dasan v'Aviram said Lashon Hara against Moshe, right? Dasan v'Aviram were the ones who revealed that Moshe killed the Egyptian. The short answer is, yeah, of course it was Lashon Hara. But the short answer is, they didn't look at Moshe Rabbeinu as one of them. Moshe Rabbeinu is the big shot Jew who grew up in Pyro's house. So on him, he's part of the establishment. On him, they had no feelings. Yeah, of course their reasoning was wrong. We're not justifying their reasoning. But vis-a-vis the Jews that were suffering in slavery, even Dasan v'Aviram had no Lashon Hara. This is an important idea, Meir Simcha says. The physical survival of the Jewish people, the physical survival, depends on the achdus and avas Yisrael of being loyal to your people and not turning against them because you think you will get some advantage, some benefit, some leniency in the way you're being treated. To have a united front. You know, we say in the Haggadah, Vehi, right, one of the most famous passages of the Haggadah, beautiful Nigunim, Vehi Shiamda Laviseinu Volanu, and that which has stood for us and our forefathers, Shalo Echad Bilvad Amad Aleinu L'chaloseinu. It is not only one that stands against us to destroy us, but in every generation there are those who try to destroy us, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu who saves us from their hands. So the phrase Shalo Echad Bilvad Amad Aleinu is translated, it is not only one that has tried to destroy us. The Sfas Emes retranslates Shalo Echad Bilvad, it is only the fact that we are not one, that is Amad Aleinu L'chaloseinu, that tries to destroy us. Yeah.
In terms of, like, we'd get destroyed if we hit the 50th level, people, not everyone would have been on the same level, like, or Moshe and those, they would have all been, so they would never, the Jewish people wouldn't have died out in Egypt.
Well, again, though, there is a concept. There still would have been. You really don't know, number one, because when we say that if Moshe and Aaron are the leader of the people, and the people hit level number 50, Moshe Rabbeinu might be punished because of the people. That's one possibility.
God would kill Moshe.
Yes, yes. The other possibility is that the definition of the Jewish people is the 12 tribes. So if the tribes are destroyed and you just have one line, they would no longer be the Jewish people. They would be something else. But it would no longer be Am Yisrael as a nation. In fact, Chazal tell us that God's promise that the Jewish people will not be destroyed has a sub-promise to it, that there will never be a tribe that is totally wiped out. Because if a tribe would be wiped out, that would be considered to be destroying the organic nationhood of Klal Yisrael. So therefore, indeed, the Jewish people would have been destroyed had there been tribes that would have been wiped out.
Just on this idea of the Jews reaching the 50th level and then being irredeemable.
Yeah.
So we have a covenant between Hashem and the Avos that the Jewish people will live on forever. And the idea I've heard about the point of the Jewish soul being like inextinguishable, it's always like pure. So does that mean not in theory? Like in theory it could happen, but Hashem won't let it happen.
Yeah, Hashem won't let it happen. Okay. And also there is a chiluk between before Matan Torah and after Matan Torah. In other words, the Torah has now given us a mechanism by which we will never sink into the 50th level. But until Matan Torah, things were still very, very touch and go, and at least there was a theoretical possibility of a destruction of Am Yisrael. Yeah.
So it just means the majority of people were at the 49th level, not like the...
Well, we know this. We know that, and it's not just Moshe that was righteous. The entire Shevet Levi was righteous. So apparently they would not have hit level 50, but there is a possibility that they may have been killed because they're responsible for Am Yisrael. Now, let's take the second... Right, so the sakana of physical survival was addressed by not speaking Lashon Hara. Right, so that's the Isarusa Dilatata that gave us that Shmira. Now, what about spiritual assimilation? Obviously, the Jews were very spiritually assimilated. Avodah Zarah, Heferu Bris Milah. But here the Meshech Chachma says, the great thing that preserved whatever residual holiness was preserved was not intermarrying, creating a Jewish home. Because in the relationship of husband and wife, there is Hashra'as HaShechina. The Shechina is Shoroi in a bias. And therefore it was the faithfulness and commitment of husband and wife creating a bias that preserved the spiritual strength that was necessary not to sink. Again, we lost many madregas, but at least that prevented us from going into the quicksand of level number 50. Now, the third danger Rav Meir Simcha identified is the Eved does not feel connected to the past. That was addressed by not changing names. B'derech Klal, a Jewish name, is a name of an ancestor. Again, Ashkenazim name after ancestors who were not alive, Sephardim will name after ancestors who are alive, but the common denominator is it connects you to the past. A father, a mother, a grandfather, grandmother, an uncle, an aunt. Or, sometimes you name after Moshe Rabbeinu or Avraham Avinu, going all the way back. When you give a Yiddish name to somebody, a Jewish name, you are telling them, you didn't come from nowhere. You have a past, you have a kesher. You are mechuber to greatness, to holiness, to Dveikus Bashem. You have a model to follow, you have a template, you have a pathway to go. And that connects a person to the past, that tells them you're not a nobody. And even if a person is a ger, so a person might say, what do you mean, I taka don't have that yichus. But no, you're a ben Avram or a ben Sarah. If you embrace the teachings of Avram Avinu, you are Avram Avinu's child. You are the daughter of Sarah Imenu. It doesn't only have to be in a biological sense. But it connects you to the past and it gives you chizuk. And that is the preservation of a name. And then finally, the fourth sakana was a slave loses any hope that the future will be different. Rav Meir Simcha says, what we did to counteract that yiyush and that despondency was we continued to speak Lashon HaKodesh. Now, think about this. You know, Latin, at one time, was the most spoken language in the world. It was the official language of the Roman Empire, which had conquered most of the known world. I mean, America was not discovered then. Today, Latin is largely a dead language. And even within the Roman Catholic Church, you know, the Pope, you know, you're not obligated to recite prayers in Latin anymore. There are some fanatics who don't even accept the Pope. They're more Haredi than the Pope that continue to conduct the liturgy in Latin. But they are considered to be not in such good standing. You know, the official idea is that everything is in the B'chol Lashon Jatah Shomea. Now, I'll tell you a little story. I don't know if this is true. I heard it as a kid. It sounds almost too good to be true. And that is that when the United States, when the 13 colonies rebelled against England, there was such a strong anti-British sentiment among Americans that they didn't want English to be the national language of the United States. We don't want to have the same language as England. So there was some question in the Continental Congress what the language should be. So some had suggested Hebrew would be a nice language, because classical scholars like Thomas Jefferson, you know, they knew Hebrew. In fact, Hebrew used to be a mandatory language. You know, the motto of Yale University is Urim Bitumim in Hebrew letters. So the story goes that there was an actual proposal to make Hebrew the official language of the United States. And it was defeated by one vote. Now, on the other side of the coin, when Zionists started coming to Israel, many of them didn't know Hebrew, and Hebrew B'chol didn't have a lot of words for modern things. That's what Eliezer ben Yehuda tried to invented a lot of words and the like. So there was some proposal that Hebrew should not be the official language of the state of Israel. And some wanted German, because Technion, there's a lot of German-speaking professors, and some wanted English, because English was becoming an international language. So imagine how history could have been different, where, you know, you're a Balshuvi, you grew up in America, you're very fluent in Hebrew, but you come to Israel and say, gee, I can't order, I can only order a falafel in English, I really, my English isn't that good. But nevertheless, it would have helped you greatly with Torah learning, because Torah learning would have been in Hebrew and the like. Okay, but be it as it may, Latin is not, I mean, Latin is still studied academically, but it's not widely studied today. And the reason is, you study languages, unless you enjoy it, but in terms of a practical day-to-day instruction, we study languages that are helpful in day-to-day communication. And if there's not going to be a resurgence of the Roman Empire, and even in Italy, they speak Italian, why bother? If you really believe we're going to be slaves forever and ever, there's never going to be a change, there's never going to be an exodus, there's never going to be a freedom, why bother with Lashon HaKodesh? So when a father teaches his child Lashon HaKodesh, what was the father saying? Right now we're slaves, but it's not going to be forever. There will come a time, maybe not in my lifetime and maybe not even in your lifetime, that we're going to leave this place. We're going to come to our land. We're going to need our language. So we are preserving that language as an expression of our emuna and our hope that there will be a geula, there will be a Yeshua, Hashem, one way or the other, we don't know when and we don't know how, is going to bring us back to Eretz Yisrael. So you see what the Meshech Chachma is doing. There are four dangers. And for that, thank you. And for that, we needed four redemptions. But those four dangers had to be addressed by four behaviors on our part. The danger to our physical being was addressed by our not speaking Lashon Hara, meaning not turning to the authorities for temporary advantages at the expense of the group. The spiritual assimilation was addressed by not intermarrying. The connection to the past, by not changing our names. And the hope that the future will be different, by preserving a language that right now is useless, but it will be very, very important when we return to Eretz Yisrael. Now, he then says that this explains strategically why the four cups are located where they are in the Haggadah. The first kos is the kos of Kiddush. Now Kiddush means sanctification, holiness. The name for marriage is Kiddushin, a sanctified holy relationship. So the first kos, indirectly, is a celebration of the holiness of husband and wife, the holiness of the bias, reminiscent of Kiddushin, which was the antidote that protected us from total spiritual assimilation. The second kos is on the Haggadah, Magid. Now what is Magid but the story of our past? the story of the promises of Hashem made to Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, the story of the Makos, that corresponds to not changing the names. In other words, that connects every Jewish person to the history of their past. The third kos is on Birkas HaMazon. Now this is a little less obvious, but let's focus on it for a moment. Birkas HaMazon is gratitude to Hashem for what He gave us. Birkas HaMazon, I am grateful to the Almighty. When you have gratitude for what Hashem gives you, you're not jealous with what Hashem gave other people. In a way, the mental attitude you need to bring to Birkas HaMazon is Sameach B'chelko. Pirkei Avos says, Ezeu Ashir, who is a wealthy person, a person that is Sameach B'chelko. Birkas HaMazon is about gratitude. Gratitude is about being happy with what you have. When you're happy with what you have, you become wealthy. When you're wealthy, you're not jealous. Therefore, the absence of jealousy fosters unity and Avas Yisrael, which in turn, you no longer have a desire of Lashon Hara. Because Lashon Hara often comes out of jealousy, envy, animosity. So the third cup, through an indirect series of associations, corresponds to the group solidarity of Avas Yisrael that comes when you have gratitude in Hakaras HaTov. Right? So Kiddush corresponds to the spiritual danger addressed by the holiness of marriage. The Magid corresponds to the danger of disconnection to the past, which is addressed by keeping their names, and in the Haggadah, by telling the story. Kos number three corresponds to the group solidarity of being protected from physical destruction by Avas Yisrael and Achdus, and that corresponds to the not speaking Lashon Hara and invention through Hakaras HaTov, which makes me happy with my lot, and when I'm happy with my lot, I don't have any desire to demean or hurt other people. We then come to the fourth cup, which is Hallel. Now, the mitzvah of Hallel at the Seder night is... See, Hallel is not part of the mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. Hallel is really a separate mitzvah to Rabbanan. But the Hallel of the Seder is unique in many, many ways. The Chiyuv of Hallel B'Leil Seder. First of all, it is unique because Hallel is normally recited in the day. It is not recited at night. This is the only time Hallel is recited at night. Number two, the Hallel is split. Right? If you look at the Haggadah, you will notice two chapters of the Hallel are recited before we wash for the matzah, at the end of Magid, and the rest of Hallel is recited after the Afikoman, after benching, we say the rest of Hallel. In other words, Hallel is split a little bit before the meal, a little bit after. Another difference is that the Hallel of the Seder does not have a before bracha. We don't say Asher Kiddushanu b'mitzvosa v'tzivanu likro as a Hallel. We do say the after bracha, although as I say, there are two versions. Do you say the after bracha Yahalalucha with Melech Mehulal Batishbachos, or do you say Habocher B'Shir, like Yishtabach, Habocher B'Shir Yizimra Melech Kelchei Olamim? But it does have an after bracha, but there's no bracha before the Hallel. Well, I'm not going to address all of these chilukim, but the one chiluk I do want to address is the notion of splitting the Hallel, two portions before and the rest of Hallel after. And the Rishonim give a reason, because they say the first two chapters of Hallel are praising God for the Exodus, for Yetzias Mitzrayim. Indeed, the second kapitel begins, B'tzeis Yisrael mi Mitzrayim, when the Jewish people left Mitzrayim. But the Hallel after the meal is no longer the Hallel of Yetzias Mitzrayim. It is the Hallel expressing your hope and your yearning for the messianic redemption. That is why, before we say that second part of the Hallel, we open the door and we invite Eliyahu HaNavi to come in. Again, Eliyahu HaNavi's role is to be the announcer of Mashiach. So the Hallel before the Suda is a Shevach for the past. The Hallel after the Suda is Emunah, the Vias HaMashiach. That's why that hollow in particular is very, very exalted. Sometimes we don't appreciate it that much. Number one, people are tired. People have already had 3 cups of wine. They might be getting a little muddled in their head. Also, because you're not allowed to be mafsik in Hallel, so people don't, people don't discuss. They just say it. Although the Nitziv points out, if you can sing the whole Hallel with different nigunim, that would be the best way of doing it. One should sing. Hallel should be a form of Shira. But for those who understand what is going on, the Hallel after the Seder, after the meal, is very exalted. There is a feeling that you're now approaching the yearning of the Mashiach, which might even happen on Pesach itself. So, if the fourth danger is hopelessness, which we addressed in Mitzrayim with Lashon HaKodesh, in the Seder, we overcome our hopelessness with not just talking about the past, but focusing on the Messianic redemption. So you see, this is kind of a very, very beautiful pattern. 4 dangers, 4 redemptions, 4 responses on our part, and this explains why the 4 kosos are staged where they are in the particular order of the Seder. One other final grammatical point about this. You know, on the before we drink the second cup, we finish the Maggid, and we do have a bracha, a long bracha, which ends, Baruch Atah Hashem, Goel Yisrael. But before that, we recited the 2 paragraphs of the Hallel, and then we said Goel Yisrael. Now, right before we began the Hallel, before the meal, we don't make the bracha, Asher Kiddushanu B'mitzvosa B'tzivanu L'Kroes HaHallel, but we do say, now we're about to say to Hashem, V'nomar L'fanav, we will now say before Hashem, Shira Chadasha, a new song. That's the same lashon we say every day in davening, Shira Chadasha Shibchu Geulim. Now, in the Bracha Gal Yisrael, in which we actually say, just as we are celebrating Yetzias Mitzrayim, may God bring us to the redemption. And then it says, V'nodelecha Shir Chadash. We will give you, in English it's the same translation, we will give you a Shir Chadash. And grammatically there's a problem. How come before Hallel, I described Hallel B'lashon Nekeva, Shira Chadasha? But in the Bracha of Gal Yisrael, I described the song of the future as Shir Chadash, which is Lashon Zachar. What is the difference between Shira Chadasha and Shir Chadash? So Tosfos in Arvei Pesachim actually answers this question. And Tosfos says that all of the songs in this world are B'lashon Nekeva. Because when a woman gives birth to a child, even though it's a joyous event, there is the pain both before the birth and there is the pain after the birth. The woman suffers. There is pain. So too, in this world, with all of the redemptions that Hashem has brought the Jewish people, there continue to be pain and suffering. But Liasid Lavo, the future song of Mashiach will be like the song of a man, because a man does not suffer physical pain in childbirth or afterwards. And therefore the remez will be that after the Mashiach comes, now beforehand there will still be pain, these are the birth pains of Mashiach to be sure, but it's Lashon Zachor, because after the Mashiach comes, there will no longer be suffering, there will be no longer pain. So in this world, when we praise Hashem for Yetzias Mitzrayim, we call the Hallel Shira Chadasha, because like in a Nekeva, even after the birth there is Tsar. But the Shir Chadasha of the Geula will be like a Zachar that suffers no Tsar. And after the Geula, there will only be goodness and happiness. So that's why there's a Chilak. That's why one needs to pay attention even to little things in the Haggadah. Of course, you know, it's very, very overwhelming. There are more commentaries on the Haggadah than there are on the Chumash. really, really unbelievable. And every year, there might be 15 to 20 new Haggadahs that come out. And now what people do, again, it's legitimate, is even Gedolim who didn't write on the Haggadah, people now make Haggadahs out of. So, for example, the Sfas Emes. Sfas Emes did not write on the Haggadah, but obviously the Sfas Emes has a lot of things in the Chumash on Yetzias Mitzrayim. So people now are malakeh. They take from these Svarim and they make the Haggadah of the Sfas Emes. Or the Haggadah of Rav Tzadok. Rav Tzadok didn't write on the Haggadah, but Rav Tzadok said many things, right? So the Meshech Chachma, they put out a Haggadah of the Meshech Chachma as well. So not only do you have gazillions of commentaries on the Haggadah, but any Sefer on Chumash can be mined to make a Sefer. The Haggadah of the Ramban, right? The Ramban didn't write it, right? Haggadah of the Ramban, right? It says it's even Haggadah of Rashi, taking all of Rashi's comments. So it's very, very overwhelming to know what to look at. I know that discussion. I can't really advise you so much because everybody has a different taste. You know, everyone has a different neshama. Everyone has a different thing that's moshech them. Some like Hasidisha things, and some like Musar thoughts, and some like stories, and some like deeper pshat. Some like halachic analysis. There's also a mitzvah to think about the various halachos of Pesach as well. So you're going to have to kind of play it by ear and the like. But again, one should know. In fact, I even saw now a Holocaust Haggadah where each part of the Haggadah is like a story of spiritual heroism in the Holocaust. I said, well, one looks at all these different things. But one should not allow all of the details to obscure the central message of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's love for Am Yisrael, and his care and his concern for us, and the fact that he took us out of Mitzrayim so we should become his special nation, and that every single year we get together to remember this, and this should give us chizuk and inspiration and strength to continue to be faithful Jews and to walk in Hashem's ways. So there might be a million different ways of getting to that idea, but the central idea is a basic one and a simple one, and one that we need to remember always. So, let's see what time it is. I can... Yeah, so I have some time for questions or anything you want to discuss. Yeah.
You mentioned on the Haggadahs. I was hoping you could maybe just point out a few that are very cohesive in their theme and message, because I was reading a couple different ones, and like you said, like the Haggadah I was reading, it just had warts on everything.
Yeah,
got it, and I'm like, I don't know, it
kind of
just throws me off.
Like, yeah, yeah, so it's true. I'm really the same way. The art scroll format is very difficult sometimes because this word is this, and that word is this, and that word is that. Yeah, so there are a few. Well, again, there are so many that are good. Rabbi Abraham Twersky has a Haggadah in English, From Slavery to Freedom. Again, it's an art scroll. Art scroll publishes a million Haggadahs. That's a very good Haggadah because he does have a central theme. And the central theme is the Bala Tanya's idea, which I talked about last Shabbos, that every person has their own personal slavery. And Yetzias Mitzrayim is a koach that allows you to be liberated from your slavery. So that's a very good Haggadah. And there's a Breslover Haggadah. Again, I think Art School even does that. So they do everything. Which is the same, kind of the same way, with more Hasidish aspect to it. So those I think are useful because they give you a central idea to look at. Another very good Haggadah, which is a combination of some very nice thoughts with some good halacha, is called Hegyone Halacha, which I think has been translated in English now as well. Hegyone Halacha, very, very excellent Haggadah. And it's short. I think unless you have the time, which you need to avoid, unless you have the time, is you need to avoid Haggadahs that have long, complicated... What are you going to do? You're sitting at the Seder, you know, I got to read this 10-page... you need things that are relatively digestible but meaningful at the same time. So unless you have a lot of pre-Pesach time, short is better than long, unfortunately, even though obviously a short thought may not always be as developed as a longer thought. But those are some that would be good. I had mentioned I got a Masokla Or, but yeah, that's a little also a little longer, you have to live. But for the table use itself, I think Rabbi Twersky, Breslov, and Hegyone Halacha might be very good. Yeah.
You know the pasuk in the Torah, I asked the rabbi yesterday about it, the one that says we came out of Egypt on the wings of eagles. And I asked him, is that to be taken literally? And he said it's actually angels. Like
yeah.
Millions of people flying on the back of angels. Like, you know, it just sounds a bit strange.
Well, you know, first of all, you know, I'll just tell you something. You know, when the now the last Jews of Yemen have just come to Eretz Israel. Maybe there may be like 20 Jews who didn't want to go, but basically, there are no longer a Jewish community in Yemen. But most of the community were very, very religious, very religious, and they came to Eretz Israel in 1948. And these were people who were very religious and learned, but they were living physically and economically. They were living very primitively. They had never seen an airplane, etc. And the first time they saw an airplane, and the first time they were on an airplane for sure, is when they came from Yemen to Eretz Israel. So all the old Yemenite people said, ah, now we understand the verse, we are being carried on the wings of eagles. They saw the airplane as a fulfillment of that. So the truth of the matter is, it was not understood as literally. The analogy is, Chumash uses in other places as well, that the eagle carries its babies on its wings when it flies, so that if there's any arrows or whatever it would be, it would attack the mother, not the babies. And therefore the concept that God is like the eagle that protects us is a symbol for divine protection, the clouds of glory and the like. So it doesn't necessarily mean people were carried in that sense, but it means they were surrounded, they were protected, that God showed the same love that an eagle would show for its children.
I read in the Stone Edition, he said what you just said there, yeah. I was happy with that, and then someone showed me a Rashi that says that it's literal.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, Rashi just...
Well, I'll look at it. I have to check it. I mean, there's no intrinsic chiyuv to say that it was absolutely literal. Because again, in Parshas Hazinu, in the Torah itself, God says about himself, Kinesher Yair Kino, as an eagle hovers over its nest, Al Gozolav Yirachev, it hovers over its children, so Hashem takes care of us. So it's using a metaphorical connection to eagles, right?
How do we understand that we traveled so far in such a short distance? Then it was just like.
Well, there are many, many mechanisms. Now, if you remember, Yaakov Avinu did the same thing. This is called Kefitza Saderech. Now, Kefitza Saderech means God contracts the ground, and that's a miracle too. But kind of, you know, you got to go from here to there. So Hashem like squishes the ground together. Which, by the way, according to Einstein, time and space relativity, that's entirely possible. You know, time and space can bend in all sorts of directions. It would be a miracle, obviously, but such a phenomenon exists in the outer reaches of the universe, the bendability of space and time. So that's called Kefitza Saderech, and that happened a lot of different places in the Torah.
So generally we just don't accept it as a literal thing.
Well, again, I'm not saying we reject the possibility, but all I'm saying is that one is not obligated necessarily to understand those psukim in a totally literal way. Yeah.
You mentioned in Gemara, there's a shita that holds you should drink fifth cup.
Yeah, Rabbi Tarfon, right.
And I was learning a little bit in our Yitzchakim, and I remember, forgot exactly, one of the Rishonim talks about the issue of Baal Tosef, if you like forget to drink a cup and then you drink more.
Yes.
So I'm wondering, why is it Baal Tosef if there's a shita that says you could drink five? Is it because after the halakha is four, so then it would be Baal Tosef?
That would be the svara, meaning the one that says you're supposed to drink five, obviously it's not Baal Tosef, but if the halakha is four, so five might be Baal Tosef. But Lamaisa, we paskin, not that way actually, we paskin that you are allowed to have a kos chamishi, but it's complicated, so the minhag is not to do it because it is very complicated. You have to kind of revise the seder a little bit, meaning, because you have to say something over the kos chamishi, right? So where would you put it in, and what would you say over it? And there are like six different views of where you put it in. So it's complicated, so our minhag is, by and large, not to do it.
Or something like during the Suda, if you want to drink more?
No, because it has to be... No, that you're allowed to drink during the Suda, but that doesn't count for kos chamishi. Because remember, the positioning of the cups is part of the mitzvah. right? Kiddush, Haggadah, benching, Hallel. So then you got to figure out where the Kos Chamishi goes, because there has to be something recited over it. Yeah.
How close to the shot of Sibrisius Pesachim do you have to be? Like, in order to fulfill that mitzvah, how close to the actual story does it have to be? Like, let's say, like for example, like Matzah or some of the drushim, like they're very, very much drush. It's not as shot. Like, oh, this is really what this is what happens.
Yeah.
Would that be yotze? Something like that.
Well, you know, that is a very, very good question. If someone simply has all sorts of drushes that are not midrushim, that are not fundamental based on Chazal, just person just says his own nice, good thoughts. And they could be Musar thoughts, or they could be Hashgafa thoughts, etc. But they're not really connected to the Exodus, per se. I think there is some question, are you Mekayim the mitzvah? You're certainly Mekayim Talmud Torah, that much, which is a great mitzvah, but it may not be the mitzvah of Sibri Tzias Mitzrayim. So that's why you try. In fact, even the thing about the Holocaust stories, you know, it's not entirely clear to me if that's a Kiyam. On the other hand, that might be a little different, maybe because you see from the Haggadah itself that part of the mitzvah of Sibri Tzias Mitzrayim is also to remember that Hashem will redeem us from all of our tzaras. In other words, I remember that in order that I should know that Hashem will bring Geula. So it could be that when you talk about other tzaras and other redemptions, that would be nichlal in that mitzvah as well. But you have to be a little careful. You have to kind of ask yourself, I mean, I don't mean every single word, but you have to ask yourself, you know, am I veering too far away from what should be the central focus?
Isn't the reading of the Haggadah that fulfilling that purpose?
Yeah. See, no. Of course, you can. Listen, if you just read the Haggadah, you'd be Yaseh too. But in terms of being marbe, the more you deal with it, the more praiseworthy. So that would mean you try to stick with that as much as possible. Yeah.
Yeah. I saw that there are a different reason given in the Yerushalmi for the Avakosos.
Yeah.
Why is everyone going with the first one of the Shemuel?
Yeah. There are a number of reasons that are given. This is the reason that the Rishonim bring most. This is the reason that Rashi brings in Arvei Pesachim. It's interesting that the Bavli, it's very fascinating. The Bavli does not give any reason for 4 cups of wine. In other words, the Rishonim just bring it from the Yerushalmi or other Midrashim. It's interesting why the Bavli does not give any reason. But why they chose this reason over the others, I'm not sure. But it is clear that they considered this to be the predominant reason. By the way, there's another interesting omission in the Bavli. In the case of Dalet Kosos, the Bavli is just omitting a reason, but certainly there's a mitzvah of Dalet Kosos. But there's a famous halacha that is actually not in the Bavli at all. And that is, you know, the halacha is you're not allowed to eat matzah on Erev Pesach. Now, many people have a minhag from Purim or Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Okay, many of you have such a minhag. But according to the din of the Shulchan Aruch, the minhag is really Erev Pesach. And even that is mutter Thursday night. It's only usher Friday morning. So Friday morning, it's usher to eat matzah even before it's usher to eat chametz. Right? You can eat chametz for the first 3 hours of the day, but you cannot eat matzah from Amud HaShachar. Now, the Talmud Yerushalmi, now in the Bavli, this is not mentioned at all. If you ask, where in the Gemara is this law brought down? It is not brought down. Which means, it might be arguable that according to the Bavli, it is mutar. The Talmud Yerushalmi is the one that says, "Kol ha'ichal matzah b'erev Pesach." Anyone that eats matzah in erev Pesach, so it compares it. Very interesting comparison. Ki'ilu boel arusaso bebeis chamiv. It is as if you had intercourse with your arusa when she's still in the father-in-law's house or her father's house. In other words, the concept is an arusa is gonna be mutter later, but now it's usher. Matzah is the same thing. In fact, the Rishonim say, this is hard to figure it out, the Rishonim give a good comparison to Arusa. Why do they compare eating matzah to being Bayal and Arusa? Because an Arusa is not muteres until you have 7 brachas. You have to recite 7 brachas under the chuppah. Kala without a bracha, until you say the 7 brachas, Asura, Labala, Kenida. So they point out that there are seven, this is always hard to hard, you get to seven. They point out there are seven blessings you recite at the Seder before you get to the matzah. So it's like an arusa, you need sheva brachos to matzah. Now if you start counting though, it's not so simple. Let's count. How many brachos do you say at the Seder? So the Kiddush, Berei Pri HaGafen is one, Mekadesh Yisrael is two, Shechiyonu is three, then you say the bracha on Karpas, Berei Pri Adama, which is four, then you have the bracha of Goal Yisrael at the end of Magid, which is five, then you have a second Berei Pri Adama, but I'll talk about that, which is six, or, oh, you're right, then Al-Natila Shadayim, which is seven, and then you have Hamotzi and Al-Achilas Matzah, which is nine. So there's actually nine brachos that you recite before you get to the matzah. So how do you get seven? So, like Svardim, it works out very well, because Svardim only make a bracha on the first cup and on the third cup. They don't make on the second and the fourth. So by Svardim, you take out the one Berei Pri HaGafen, so that gets you down to eight. Eight brachos per se. And then some say you don't count Karpas as a separate bracha, because Karpas was only put in there so the children, the whole ceremony of dipping the vegetable in water, was in the salt water, was only there to stimulate the curiosity of the children, so it's not an absolute chiyuv. So if you take out, so apparently the Yerushalmi only fits like Sephardim, if you take out Karpas and the second bracha over Berei Pri HaGafen, so you will have seven brachos that you have to recite before you eat the matzah. And that's why the Talmud Yerushalmi says, Kala b'loi bracha asur l'bayla kenida. Now this creates a very interesting problem for those the firstborn that have to fast on Erev Pesach. We know that the way we matur the eating is with a siyum. Right? Somebody finishes a Masechta. Now, in order for a siyum to be a sudas mitzvah, it has to be something that's either mizonos or hamotzi. Now, the question is, what can you eat Erev Pesach morning? Now, a matzah you cannot have, because matzah is forbidden all day, and that even includes matzah meal cake. Potato starch cake, which is the common thing, is a shahakol. So that actually is not acceptable for a siyum. Matzah meal cake, some would say, that maybe is also not acceptable because of the matzah meal. Now bread, chametz, is still good, or even regular cake, is still good because you can eat chametz until 3 hours. But the problem is, some people don't like, you know, it's Erev Pesach, and I don't want there to be, right? So some permit what is called, some permit egg matzah. Tosas Nari Pesachim, because egg matzah is matzah flour that was mixed at the time of baking with egg yolk or wine and the like. And this is called matzah ashira, rich matzah, as opposed to regular matzah that's lechem oni, poor matzah. And Tosas Nari Pesachim says that the prohibition of eating matzah on Erev Pesach is only the type of matzah that is kosher for the Seder, which is lechem oni, and therefore matzah ashira is permitted until the Zman of the Isser Chametz, because Ashkenazim don't eat Matzah Ashira once you can't have Chametz. Sephardim actually can eat Matzah Ashira even after that. Now, of course, you'll ask me a question, well, wait a second, if I'm telling you you can have egg matzah, then why can't you have matzah meal cake? Matzah meal cake also is mixed with chocolate and egg. I mean, what is the difference in egg matzah and matzah meal cake? There actually is a difference. Because matzah meal cake is actually made with regular ground up matzah that then gets mixed in with ingredients. So the svara is, since it was regular matzah, it has the same isser of matzah. As opposed to the egg matzah, it's baked in the first instance with all these ingredients, so it never had an independent status of matzah. So although both of them are sweet tasting, there is a difference.
One of the reasons why the Jewish people were redeemed is because they had Jewish names.
Yes.
So say for example one's grandparents changed their name in the past. from a Jewish name to just an Irish name, for example, would there be any benefit to change it back?
Now, you're talking about a last name, I'm assuming.
Yeah,
so the truth of the matter is, last names, of course, are not really part of one's fundamental Jewish identity, because, you know, last names are a recent invention from the Goyim, so to speak. Peter the Great required family names. It wasn't even that common. But I wouldn't say your first name is much more important, but I think there is an inyan of Jewish pride and solidarity, and to turn your back on assimilation, to reclaim the Jewish name, so to be a Goldstein instead of something else, O'Hara or whatever. I think there would be an inyan of doing that. Yeah. Yeah.
Similar to Brian's question, when we have there's so many midrashim on the Yetzirah Mitzrayim, and they vividly illustrate for you what's going on, and it's nice you can connect it to,
yeah,
and you can be amazed by all the
right.
But so can we just believe everything literally? Is there a problem with that if it's going to enhance your emunah, or do you have to decide which ones are literal, or how does that work?
Well here's the thing, obviously everything Chazal say is true, everything is true, but as the Maharal says, truth is sometimes a literal thing and sometimes it's intended to give you a spiritual message. Now, how do you know which is which? Rambam says, after he says this, the Rambam writes, I'm going to write a sefer that will tell you exactly which midrashim are meant to be literal and which midrashim are not literal. The Rambam said he was going to write such a sefer, but v'naseinu harabim, we don't have it. Either he didn't get around to writing it, or it got lost somehow. Imagine what such a sefer would be. So the Rambam could give you answers that I'm not able to give you. Now, I think right now, all you need to know is that we don't know what is literal, what is not, and therefore, you're not mechuyev to believe it's literal, but you're not mechuyev to believe it's not literal. And therefore, each person makes his mind up there, because we don't really have a definitive teaching on that. But the message, no matter which way, is that Hashem's love was very, very great for the Jewish people.
What's the story behind the splitting of the halal? I mean, not the splitting of the halal, more like, since we say the full halal, since we don't say the full halal, for example, is the full halal the first 2 days of Yom Tov?
So why
the split happens the way it happens?
So the answer is that the times that we say a half halal, mm-hmm, have different reasons. It's not a unified reason. On Rosh Chodesh, the reason we say a half halal is because halal on Rosh Chodesh is not a chiyuv, it is only a minhag. Mm-hmm. And to show that it's not a chiyuv, we split it. We say we don't say the whole thing.
Even though we say some say
well, and that's why some don't say a bracha. Ashkenazim would say a bracha, say once it becomes a minhag, it becomes an obligation. But mm-hmm, to remember that it's a minhag, we only say half. Now, the other time we say a half halal is the last day of Pesach, seventh day of Pesach, or the eighth day in Golos. Now that's already a different reason. That already is the commiseration that our joy is diminished, because that's when the Egyptians died in Kriyas Yamsuf. So we say a half halal there. So that's a different reason than Rosh Chodesh. So those are the only two occasions, right? The only two occasions of half halal are seventh and eighth day of Pesach in the Golos, and Rosh Chodesh, mm-hmm, and they have two different reasons.
Is that as far as to why it happens the way it happens? Why we cut this certain Tehillim as opposed to the other ones? Or
why we cut those particular?
Right,
things.
That's the other part of the question.
That's a little more difficult. Rashi makes the following point. You have to sit down with a sitter and look at this.
Yeah.
Rashi says that the cut was made because the second half is a virtual repetition, pasuk by pasuk, of the first half in different words. So therefore, you're not losing any new idea. That's what Rashi says. So you have to check. You can actually compare the first half that you cut with the second half, and you'll see that the second half is a reiteration. Now, that's very schwer, because we normally wouldn't assume that something is just a repetition. But that's what Rashi says. Rashi in Sukkah says, we skip the first half because it's repeating the second half, so when we have to cut something, we want to cut something in which we're not losing new ideas. Uh-huh. That's what Rashi says. But you have to look. Yeah. Yeah.
Rabbi, a bit of an off-topic question. When walking on the street and being whatever, when you're in your head, Do you think it's better to think about things like related to Hashem, talk to Hashem, whatever, or to chazer things in your head from what you learned during the day?
Well, I'm not going to give you a preference. I mean, Baruch Hashem, I mean, it's better than Divrei Chol, it's better than just looking around at all the all of the priests that exist in the street. If you're asking me what type of thing should I think about, I would say you think about whatever is ma'ori, or whatever arouses you in the most powerful way. Now, it may not be the same thing every time. It's a good thing to have Mishnayos or something that you learned that you're thinking about, but to think about Hashem is also a wonderful, wonderful thing. So I wouldn't say there's an ironclad preference there. Yeah.
When I was growing up in Jewish schools, I always learned that the tenth plague was done by the angel of death.
The angel of death would pass by all the houses. Yes. Yeah. Yes. No. In fact, there seems to be a contradiction in the Chumash itself. On one hand, we say Hashem says I will pass, and not an angel. But then Hashem says, when you put the blood on your doorways, I will not let the angel of death come into your houses, implying that the angel of death was doing it. Right? So that is a contradiction. That is a contradiction. One answer that the Mefarshim give is that the plague of the firstborn was done by God. But since the night of Pesach was a special protected night, the Malach HaMavis was disabled from doing his customary rounds, meaning some people were scheduled to die normally, that was their date. But because of the Karban Pesach, the angel of death didn't even do his normal work that night. That is one answer. Rebbe Kiv Eger actually gives a whole other answer. It's part of a much longer thing. But his basic idea is that there are two types of firstborn. There's a firstborn of a father and a firstborn of a mother. Now, a firstborn of a mother can be identified because we know the mother never gave birth before. The firstborn of a father in a promiscuous society like Egypt, you know, nobody would be able to know except Hashem. So he says, the angel of death was entrusted with killing the firstborn of the mothers, but only Hashem could kill the firstborn of the fathers, because even the angels couldn't keep track of where these Egyptian men were having their babies. So that's another.
According to that, also, it's still in the Haggadah, it says Hashem and no angel is still there.
Yes, so according to Rebbe Kiv Eger, that would refer to the Bechor Me'av, not the Bechor Me'im. By the way, the Haggadah makes a drasha, Ani, I, v'lo Malach, and not an angel. Ani, v'lo Saraf, again, a higher angel. Ani, v'lo HaShaliach, and not an emissary. So it's pointed out that Mem for Malach, and Sin or Shin for Saraf, and Hey for HaShaliach, spells out Moshe, that the Haggadah emphasizes we should not attribute the Geula to Moshe Rabbeinu. As you know, it's a very famous observation that Moshe Rabbeinu's name is not mentioned in the Haggadah. Now, it's mentioned once in the middle of Kriyas Yamsuf, Yaminu Bashem Uva Moshe Avdo. But that's not really part of the original Haggadah. That was added later. It's not in the Rambam's Haggadah Bichlal. So, the Torah de-emphasizes, not the Torah, let's forget, the Torah very much emphasizes, but the Haggadah de-emphasizes the role of Moshe Rabbeinu, because we are to think only of HaKadosh Baruch Hu on this night. And in fact, that's why it is said, people ask the Kasha, why don't we take the story in Shemos? Shemos is the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. We should read the verses of Shemos. Instead of taking those four verses about the first fruits and then bringing in verses from Shemos, let's just read Shemos. Right? Why don't we read Shemos? So there are two answers. One is, to read the whole narrative of Shemos, that's 12 prakim of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Actually, until you get to Kriyas Yamsuf, it's 14 prakim. That would have been too much. So Chazal gave us a short form. But the other answer that's given is that if you read Shemos, you're gonna bump into Moshe Rabbeinu every single time. And if the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, where Miyased the Haggadah, where Moshe Rabbeinu is de-emphasized, they had to find the text that didn't mention Moshe Rabbeinu. And those were the four verses of Bikurim. And then we bring in selected verses from Shemos to augment those verses. But this way, Moshe Rabbeinu is not mentioned. They say this is Moshe Rabbeinu's greatest accomplishment, that his humility, the Anav Mikol Adam, is that he conceals his role even in Yetzias Mitzrayim. So I wish you all a Chag Kosher V'Sameach. Yeah.
Someone who has a hard time saying the whole Haggadah, what parts should he say?
Yes, so you need to say this. You need to say four questions, the Manishtana, or have somebody say it. You need to say the first paragraph of Avodim Hayinu. You need to say Rabban Gamliel at the end of Maggid. Kol Shalai Omar Shlosha Devarim Halalu B'Pesach Pesach Matzah Moror. And then, then you say the halal. The rest you have to say, but you've finished Maggid already, but the halal you have to say. You can't cut down in the halal itself. But the Maggid, there's a lot that you could leave out if you have to. Yeah. But the problem is that the halal is the one thing you can't leave out, even though people get less excited over it. Which means to say, here's the paradox. The part of the Haggadah that people like the most, people love the four sons, and they love the story of the rabbis being up all night, etc. And we're still fresh and we're not tired. Those are bedafka, the parts you're allowed to skip, if you have to skip it. The parts that people like the most are the parts that, halachically, there's less of a chiyuv to say. Yeah.
And so when can you say the Maggid?
So, so here's the thing. The Maggid should be said before midnight, just like the matzah should be eaten before midnight. However, it is brought down that even after Chatzos, there's a mitzvah to continue talking about Yetzias Mitzrayim. So the basic Maggid should be finished before Chatzos. But then there's a mitzvah to be Marba even afterwards. Kol Oso HaLaila. Okay, wish you all Chag Kosher Sameach, a wonderful Yom Tov, and may it be a Chodesh of Geula and Yeshua for all of us.